This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because, well, what better place to gather around this time of day and, you know, talk about what's on our minds? And today we're going to talk about it with a couple of people who love to talk about poetry, especially cowboy poetry. Joining us by phone from near Sentinel Butte, North Dakota, is Bill Lohman. He's the founder and director of the Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering, and that's what we're going to be talking about. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Doug. Yeah, thank you.
And Jonathan Oderman is calling from his ranch in the Badlands of Western North Dakota near Medora. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today.
Yep. Good morning.
Well, Bill, give us the lowdown. This is the 32nd annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering coming up on Memorial Day weekend in Medora. What can people expect?
Okay, yeah, that's Saturday, May 26th and Sunday, May 27th. We start at 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon right after lunch and an open mic. People, singers and poets of the cowboy tradition get up and share their works with people, and it'll run till about 4:30 or 5 o'clock. We break, and then we have a professional night show at 7:30. And then Sunday, we do it all over again, the same thing at 1 o'clock, and another different night show Sunday night. Sunday mornings, we have from 9 till 11:30, we have a cowboy gospel singing. It's not church. It's just kind of a laid-back round-robin thing where anybody who wants to sing cowboy gospel songs can come up and do it, and it packs them in. It's real popular. So, yeah, we didn't know when we started that, and when we first started a poetry gathering, that Sunday morning was half of them were had hangovers and half of them were in church. So, so we didn't know what to do with it. So we started this. We call it Separating the Saints from the Sinners.
Aha. Jonathan, I saw you online getting an award a couple of years ago at the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada. Are you relatively new at this, or how long have you been writing cowboy poetry?
Well, I guess I made my debut in December of 2015 at the Cowboy Hall of Fame in Medora. Fran Armstrong had a small program there, and you know, I guess I'd been writing poetry for a while, but I hadn't really presented to anybody. And I got going on this event for Fran, and within a month I decided, well, you know, I should probably start doing some more of this. And I got on the internet, and I found that they had a scholarship that they were offering for Elko, and so I applied for that. And within a month I'm, you know, doing my first presentation of cowboy poetry, and then I'm in Elko, Nevada, getting a scholarship and presenting on stage to a very large audience. And it was just, you know, a really neat experience. It was really neat.
Bill,
say the least.
How do you define cowboy poetry?
To me, cowboy poetry is recording day-to-day life of the culture. And to me, I'm not big on awards and judging thing. I've always been an advocate of a non-judged event. Each person has their own style and stuff. And even if their poetry is a little bit rough and meter isn't quite right, if they live that and live that event they're writing about, they're the authority on it. Where a high scholar can't say, no, this is wrong and you didn't do this right. And they're the ones that lived it, and it's recording cowboy culture. We're an oral tradition from way back in the trail drives from the late 1800s into the upper states up here out of Texas and stuff, and that was all an oral tradition that wasn't written down, and now we're trying to kind of record that in these poetry gatherings. Otherwise, it will get lost.
Well, Jonathan, this year the poetry gathering will include the art exhibit at the Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering in the Roosevelt Room, I guess, of the Medora Community Center. Describe this art exhibit. How does it work?
Okay. Well, the simplest way is to think of it as a game of Pictionary, except the major twist is that it's a lot more detailed and complicated, because instead of just one word that you're trying to get through an image to get somebody else to guess, you've got an entire poem that gets painted as best the painter can, and then you've got two other poets that try to recreate a poem inspired by the painting.
Wow.
And it's absolutely incredible to see how, from one side to the other, what gets lost in translation and what comes through, and sometimes even things that aren't even really mentioned directly come through. And a great example of this is Bill Lohman had done a line drawing for us of one of the poems, and I'll be sharing that later. But that poem that I wrote that he painted from was inspired by a painting by a gal in Moriarty, New Mexico. Her name is Sonia Britton. And just a fabulous painting that she did. We had some problems getting the replica shipped up, so we're going to have a poor representation there at the exhibit. But there's a horse in this original painting that inspired me to write the poem. And doggone it, if without saying a word about this horse, Bill didn't draw the same horse in his image. I mean, just like magic happened between that poem and the two paintings to get it there. And, you know, just really, really neat stuff like that. What else to say about it? But that's pretty much it. We've got 10 images coming in. We've got 10 images coming in, and each image has a minimum of 3 poems with it. And we've got artwork from North Dakota, New Mexico, Alberta, Texas, Wyoming, Manitoba, Washington, Oregon, Oklahoma. I mean, this is really a nationwide talent pool that we're pulling from, so it's really, really neat.
It's so. A poet, painter, poet project.
Yes, quite literally. Right. It's a bit of a tongue twister, but boy, I tell you what, I think this is going to be a really, really special exhibit.
Well, Bill, I know that you do a lot of things. You perform, obviously. I found out when I went online you do construction, you offer hunting treks and lodging on your ranch, and you teach writing and art.
Yeah, the last one there, I was 2 4-year terms at the North Dakota Council on the Arts as an artist in residence, where I'd go in for a week or two into schools and work with kids on it to give the teachers a break. Yeah, getting back to the full question, yeah, I'm ranching. We're 20 miles north of Sentinel Butte in the Badlands, kind of 10 miles up above where Jonathan's at. In fact, we're neighbors, and I've always we come through the hard times, through the dry 80s and stuff, and you were forced to do a lot of things off the ranch to stay on the ranch, and we're survivors. We refuse to fail, so we will do what we have to keep the wolf off the door. So I don't have time for any hobbies I have. I have to turn them into a business because I don't have time for a hobby or the financial time for a hobby. So, yeah, that's and I don't know. There's A and B type people to me. There's ones that if an opportunity comes, they will take it and take the risks, and there are ones that don't do it and wish they would have later. And I've always felt that with and we grew up entertaining ourselves. We didn't have electricity till 1970, and we didn't have phones till many, many years later, and we entertained ourselves. We broke our own horses. We played ball. We played cards with neighbors. We entertained ourselves. We didn't have a TV or anything.
Well, Jonathan, you mentioned a poem that had been inspired by a painting that you saw or some art that you saw, so share this with us.
Okay. The title of the painting that inspired it was Cowboy, Be Careful What You Do, and the title of the poem is also the same. A little man with little hands, wonders of growing up. He's seen bigger men with bigger hands dip and chew that stuff. But knowing eyes give knowing sighs that try to warn this pup that little dips and little lips don't make a cowboy tough. So, cowboy, remember to be careful of what you do and think of all the little eyes that might be watching you.
That sounds like a cowboy who might be somewhere on the East Coast. Well, that's pretty interesting, Jonathan. Bill, did you contribute art to this exhibit?
Yeah, Jonathan asked me if I wanted to, and yeah, I done a visual art piece for that. Not knowing what the poem was, I just had the front line, right, Jonathan? Just the
you had the poem that I recited to you. You had the text.
Okay,
you didn't know who wrote it. And you didn't know what was in front of it. All you had was just that little bit that I read on the air.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And now you said, Jonathan, you said there's another one, done another painting to it, huh?
Well, the poem that I wrote was inspired by a painting by this gal in New Mexico. And we're going to have a small image of that. We had trouble getting the reproduction up to the quality of everything else in the show, but I'm just going to have a little snapshot of it there. I started out this project because I wanted to be poem, painting, poem. But this gal, you know, most of our artists are multi-talented. They'll write poetry, they'll do paintings and that kind of thing. And anyway, I was visiting with Sonia, and she said, well, I did this painting that a few years back, and I don't know how many is a few, it could be 10, 20 years. And, you know, she sent me an image of it, and I was just, like, blown away. I mean, it was just she has the way of capturing an event at a very pivotal moment where you can just see everything as it's about to happen, and just, you know, it's just really neat. And it was so inspiring to me that I woke up in the middle of the night and I wrote the words to go with the painting that I saw. And, you know, she loved the words that we came up with, and I said, well, that's how we're going to get it in the show. At least we've got a poem about it. I'll send it to somebody else to paint it, and this will be special because it's a painting into words back to another image, which will go back to words again, so we can really see how things change and progress, and it's fascinating. It really is, because I never mentioned a horse in that poem at all, and there was a horse in the first image, and Bill drew a horse in his image, and I mean, the way that the expression on the face is, the reins are hanging, everything, I mean, it's just like, wow, the similarity is very striking, and it was just really cool.
Has this been done before at other gatherings, you know?
I believe that there's been something similar done in Montana a few years ago. I heard about something kind of through the grapevine that had happened, and I was thinking, well, maybe this, you know, maybe there's somebody in North Dakota that's doing this. And so in 2016, after I got back from Lewistown, I started kind of hunting around, and you know, it's like, no, nobody's doing it, nobody's doing it. And I said, finally, the idea occurred to me that, well, if nobody else is doing it, maybe I could do it. And in January of this year, I started laying some feelers out, and the response I got was really overwhelming. Everybody was like, yeah, I'm on board, let's do this. And then I started taking some of the images that were coming in and some of the poems that were coming in, and I started going to businesses around Medora where I frequent or things like that, and I told them about my idea, and I showed them what we were doing, and boom, you know, instantly we were on board, and so we got funded real quick, and then I had a responsibility because everybody's like, yeah, you got to do this, and they're backing it up with their checkbook, and so now I'm running an exhibit, and it's fabulous. It really is.
Does anything happen to these collaborations after the exhibit over the Memorial Day weekend?
Okay, so some of the images will be for sale. Some of the poems that go with the images will be for sale. The premiere is at the Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Medora. And then after that, we're going to take about a two-week break because the Cowboy Hall of Fame will host the exhibit after June 15th. And so there's going to be a two-week break where we're kind of going to store the exhibit. And then June 15th, we're going to set it up in the upstairs of the Cowboy Hall of Fame, and it'll be on display there until after the 4th of July.
Sounds like at some point you could have a pretty nice coffee table book here.
Oh, you know what? That is absolutely, absolutely in the cards. My wife does a great job of taking pictures and that kind of thing, and her, she doesn't know it yet. I'm going to volunteer on the air, but I'm absolutely going to try and solicit her to take pictures of these paintings, and we're going to put them together with a poem and try and get it in a book. Because, yeah, it's really, really a special exhibit. And I'm so proud that we've got people like Bill and Fran Armstrong, so some strong North Dakotans, as well as all the other artists from all over. We got Ray Wilgus from Oklahoma. He's a painter, used to work at Cartoon Network. And he was telling me, I was talking with him, he's like, yeah, I was painting up in Canada, and there was this book that came along. Somebody was calling it Harry Potter or whatever, and I didn't have a whole lot of time, and they wanted me to do some illustrations for the book, and I told them I didn't think I could get to it, so I passed on it. And we all know how big Harry Potter turned out for kids in that era. And so he's like, yeah, I kind of wish I hadn't passed on that, but, you know, it was But you had to be somebody special to get asked to do something like that.
Well, Bill Lohman is our artist and poet from Sentinel Butte, North Dakota area, and, of course, the founder and director of the Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering. So sort of the old man, I guess, here, Bill. Have you got a poem for us?
Okay, yeah. This is, again, recording history. And this one I call it My Brothers and I, and I grew up the youngest of four. I've had two older brothers and older sister. But that's pretty well self-explanatory, my brothers and I. We grew up in the 50s and 60s, strong, rough, reckless, and sleek. We'd pick a fight with a blue northern most any day of the week. We made a habit of teasing the vultures and cheating the undertaker out of his pay. We busted our tails all day in the sun, but when night fell, we'd go out to play. We judged a girl by the distance between her hind pockets. Miller, Ole, and Bud were our friends. Dad gave us no slack the next morning. Day's work started when the daylight begins. But when the weekends come, we'd be at it again out on the rodeo trail. In the rough stock events, we competed, and with luck, have a check in the mail. We hand-dug and hand-set railroad ties by the hundred, score after score, and pitched hay all day in the hot, grilling sun till every muscle we owned was sore. We dug in water lines with our shovels that measured in miles, not feet, and mined lignite from Wanigan's creek bank for the winter supply of heat. We drew short straw to shut down the Jacobs behind the house on the point of a bluff at midnight with lightning snapping our britches, never once thinking our lives were tough. We started colts and took in rank horses that others had tried and give up. We never allowed ourselves to be beaten and lived as carefree as our border collie pup. We wrestled and heeled calves at the brandings, chopped ice and fed cows at 40 below. Now, at 70, I can't figure out why my joints hurt. I'm stooped over and slow. While others are still young at 80, yet limber and handing out smiles, I've come to this deep thought conclusion. It ain't the years, but all the hard miles, my brothers and I.
Oh, Bill Lohman. Bill, how many people do you expect at this big deal in Medora next weekend?
Thank you. We've got 35 entries with our day and nighttime people, which is just perfect. We've run over the 31 years prior to this from 25 to 50, and when we get 50, well, it's kind of hard on everybody gets short on their time. So this is just perfect. It's really a solid family year after year after year. And our night shows, we have some real good talent in. We have a good friend from Durango, Colorado, Sam Noble, a good old cowboy. He's coming up to do some poetry. We have Vic Anderson from Estes Park, Colorado, a cowboy out of Montana originally. He'll do our finish up. He's an excellent yodeler, and I will emcee that. Sunday night we've got Ann Seacrest Hansen out of Bowman down here. She's used to pick up the top saddle broncs in the world. She's in the Fort Worth Cowgirl Hall of Fame. Pat Mead, a good cowboy singer out of Iowa, Margaret Wilhelm from White Sulphur Springs, Montana, and Greg Hager out of Valley City, a good cowboy singer, and Terry Swartz out of Jamestown, a good friend and cowboy, will be emceeing that. So we've got a good lineup. It's fast-moving. You know, if one poem or one song doesn't quite suit you, why just sit tight and somebody else will come on. So it's real entertaining. We mix our cowboy singers and our cowboy poets, so it isn't one or the other, and it's real entertaining, and everybody's a friend. It's the weekend before Medora really gets started with the tourist thing with the amphitheater and stuff, so we're kind of the ticket in town in Medora that weekend, and everybody's a friend that comes through the door. There's no strangers, and all of the shops and cafes should be open, so it'll be a fun time.
The 32nd Annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering with the art exhibit at that gathering as well. It's Saturday and Sunday. That's May 26th and 27th at the Medora Community Center. Bill Lohman, founder and director of the gathering, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having us.
And Jonathan Oderman, the Poet, Painter, Poet Project Director at the gathering, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living. celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Natural North Dakota is the title of a series of essays written and voiced by Chuck Lura. Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Bottineau, and his essays focus on the plant and animal life that lives in our part of the world. Today he's talking about a plant that is well known in Western lore, the tumbleweed.
Some of you may have seen or heard the news recently about the tumbleweeds invading areas of California and Utah. Some national news services picked up the story. Apparently, strong winds blew the tumbleweeds across the landscape, piling them up in the backyards, up against privacy fences and such, creating quite a nuisance. Although several species of plants may tumble across the landscape, tumbleweeds are usually Russian thistle or Salsola iberica. It's an annual broadleaf plant native to Eurasia. And unlike many introduced weeds of unknown origin, Russian thistle is well known to have been brought to the United States, more specifically South Dakota, as a contaminant in flaxseed in 1873. Like many annuals, Russian thistle is a prolific seed producer. Each plant may produce around 250,000 seeds. When the seeds are mature and the plant dies, the stem breaks off, and the plant then often proceeds to bounce across the countryside, spreading seeds as it goes. The viability of Russian thistle is high, but short-lived. Maybe a year or so. The seedlings, however, are not very competitive with other plants, thus they really need a patch of disturbed bare ground to become established. The seeds of Russian thistle are important food items for a wide variety of birds and small mammals, plus pronghorn and prairie dogs are known to utilize the foliage. It might surprise you, but Russian thistle is a well-known food for livestock during the Dirty 30s. Cattle and sheep utilize young plants, and it's generally regarded as having fair to good palatability. It's also a good source of phosphorus and vitamin A, and when young, has a protein content that may be around 8%. Once the plant begins to flower, however, it becomes coarse and spiny, so as you'd expect, palatability and utilization drops precipitously. Seeing Russian thistle bouncing across the landscape is a common sight in many parts of North Dakota, and it will likely continue to be so. However, it seldom creates the nuisance that leads to national news stories. But no doubt a few of us have occasionally dealt with this tumbling nuisance. Let's just hope it's not necessary to use it as a forage this summer. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, Sue Balcom of Root Cellars Farm joins us to talk about Strawberries and Cream Day, and Prairie Public's Darcy Backegaard will drop by to preview The Great American Read. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Dakota Gasification Company has entered into a joint partnership with OCINV to sell nitrogen fertilizer and diesel exhaust fluid in North America. The joint venture is being named N7 LLC.
It's called N-7 because nitrogen is the seventh element in the periodic table.
Kurt Pearson is a spokesman for Basin Electric Power Cooperative, the parent company of Dakota Gasification. He says N7 will market and distribute more than 4.5 million metric tons of nitrogen fertilizers from the Beulah plant.
Of particular interest to the Basin Electric membership is the fact that they have complementary production facility in Iowa, and that's the Iowa Fertilizer Company near Ames, Iowa. And so if one or the other of these facilities has a technical problem, mechanical breakdown, the fertilizer would be able to be shipped from the other partner.
Pearson says this will save on shipping and marketing costs. The new company should be up and running by late summer. For the first time in 8 years, the University of North Dakota is making changes to its website. Starting this week, you'll see a new look when you go to und.edu.
We're moving to mobile-friendly templates. We like to think of them as visually stunning. We have a lot of nice photography showcasing our campus and our students and their successes throughout the site. So it's much more visual, much easier to use on a phone or a tablet. It's much more prospective student-focused than it is now.
Tara Buckley of UND's Marketing and Creative Services says you won't see all the changes today. About 30,000 pages on the site need to be revamped or eliminated, and that takes time. Buckley says work on the site began in December of 2017. And climate scientists from around the country are in Fargo this week for an annual climate conference. North Dakota State climatologist Adnan Akhuz says 28 states will be represented at the conference. It will focus on the latest climate prediction science.
And these kind of meetings are a perfect opportunity to become standardized and raise the bar, for example, and learn from each other.
Topics include extreme weather events and the effects of climate change on farmers. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in our Fargo studio. And in our Bismarck studio, we've got Sue Balcom. We're going to talk about food with Sue. She's with the Tri-County Alliance, and she and her husband operate a farm they call the Root Cellar north of Mandan. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Thank you. I hope you're having beautiful weather.
May is a month that has a lot of different food days. May 17th, National Cherry Cobbler Day. May 19th, National Devil's Food Cake Day. Did you know that May 27th is National Italian Beef Day? We've got a brisket day, a mint julep day, a strawberries and cream day, May 21st. I want to talk about strawberries.
I love strawberries. And, you know, after eating all of those greens, well, actually, you can add strawberries to your salads, too. But I like the idea of strawberries with ice cream, or maybe a strawberry rhubarb pie, which is a really popular spring thing.
Can we be picking strawberries by May?
No, I'm afraid not. I think that in a state like ours, the strawberries probably don't become seasonal until June. And with this cold, cold spring, they might be set back a little bit. I remember back in the day, though, there used to be a U Pickett strawberry farm right outside of Fargo called Mark's, I think.
They used to be all over. There used to be one in North Moorhead as well. And, of course, you go in other parts of the country where it's a little warmer, like Florida. They've got them everywhere.
I know, and it's really a sad thing that we don't have those as many U Picks up here, because there's nothing better than a strawberry that you pick yourself. Unless, of course, you can find them on sale at your local grocery store, because we don't hesitate to purchase them, even though they do come from outside the state this time of year, because strawberries are good and they're good for you.
Yeah, they're kind of a powerhouse here. What do they got going for them?
Well, they're supposedly boosting your immune system, but if you can't stand eating carrots for your eyes, you've got to eat strawberries. They maintain some blood pressure issues, and I have a little bit of arthritis coming on here, and so I'm always telling people I'm eating strawberries to help with my arthritis. They prevent heart disease, but you know, you can say that probably about most fruits and vegetables. The thing about strawberries right at this time in May is that they're usually priced right and abundant at most of your grocery stores, because they are in season in other states. And so they bring them up here. And if you look closely, you'll find them on sale just about everywhere you go.
And it's one of the most popular flavors on the planet. So how do we approach a fresh strawberry, Sue?
Ooh. Well, first of all, if you get to know me better, you will find that I'm kind of lean towards purchasing organic fruits and vegetables, and that's just a personal preference. You do want to wash strawberries when you bring them home from the grocery store, but you don't want to wash them until you're ready to prepare them or actually eat them. If you are worried a little bit about pesticides or anything unsavory on your strawberries, then you'll want to wash them in a little bit of baking soda water. Probably like, you know, a couple teaspoons of baking soda in a sink full of water.
What does the baking soda do?
It must neutralize some of those pesticides. I had always heard that you're supposed to use vinegar water, but, you know, the vinegar water in a strawberry would taint its flavor because they soak up the water. So I don't wash mine so diligently, and I certainly wouldn't use a vegetable brush on them. But, you know, you rinse them off. If there's a little bit of dirt on there or something, that all goes away. It's all good. Nobody's going to eat a truckload of strawberries. So you wash them off, and then, of course, you'll have that little green top up there. They do make special gadgets for you to pull that strawberry top or hull off of there, but you can use a small paring knife and get in there quite close.
Can you do anything with a strawberry green? Like, we throw away carrot top greens without realizing there's a lot of good things you can do and make a pesto and whatever, but is there anything with a strawberry green?
You know, you could try it, but I guess I never have. I think that I've eaten a few of them when I've been in a hurry to eat a strawberry, and especially if you're out there picking them yourself, because those greens are tender when they come straight from the plant. Now, I don't know about, what shipping does to them, but, you know, it kind of dries them out a little bit to not be connected to their root system. But I would, I've been known to eat all kinds of strange things, including soil or dirt once in a while. But I learned it later in my life that there are scientists that's how they can tell what minerals are in the soil. After you pull that green top off of there, then you want to slice them up and do sprinkle a little bit of sugar on them. Then you put them in the refrigerator, and they kind of form their own lovely juice. Mm-hmm. And then we eat that over ice cream.
Thank you.
Totally. Ice cream, if you don't want to do ice cream, you could top them with a little bit of whipped topping. I also have a strawberry pie that is kind of like a pre-baked crust that you put strawberries on, and then you pour a special thickener or the thickened juice over the top of it and eat that. And then it's almost like eating fresh strawberries with cream on them.
What about preserving strawberries?
Usually freezing them is probably the best way to go with berries. And what I do when I freeze blueberries or strawberries, anything like that, wash them first, lay them out on a cookie sheet, put them in the freezer till they're frozen solid, and then put them in a bag. So in the case that your summer is really, really hot, or you're having some sort of cool margarita or something that would require a frozen ice cube, throw that frozen strawberry whole in there instead.
That sounds really good.
Even though you said you didn't want to, wash the strawberry with vinegar, sometimes on a salad with a little vinaigrette, strawberry can be spectacular.
Absolutely. That's one of my favorite layering things. When I go to work in the morning, I'll actually layer salad ingredients. You start with your lettuce, and then you can throw some other little tangy things on top of that, and nuts and strawberries and some, vinaigrette. Mm-hmm. Or you can make your vinaigrette out of your strawberries if you have a good little blender.
Just anecdotally, it seems to me that strawberries are one of the kinds of produce that tends to get moldy a little faster than some of the other ones. I have always just, cut off that little piece of mold and gone for the rest of the strawberry. I'm
good
still alive, so I think that's okay, but maybe.
That is totally okay. Yeah. In my mind, I cut the mold off of a lot of things, bread, cheese. It just means that, things are degrading, and I would totally recommend eating your strawberries as soon as possible you bring them home from the store. But, I wouldn't – we don't waste food in a good German household. I'll tell you that right now.
Bon appetit. Sue Balcom is with the Tri-County Alliance, and she and her husband operate the Root Cellar, a small farm north of Mandan. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Thank you.
More Main Street in a moment.
Alexa, play Prairie Public.
Welcome to Prairie Public. Would you like to listen to a radio stream or listen to a podcast?
Radio stream.
If you've got a smart speaker, you can listen to Prairie Public.
Which of the two streams would you like to listen to? Roots, rock, and jazz, or classical and news?
You can also ask Alexa to play Prairie Public Podcasts.
Would you like to listen to Main Street, Natural North Dakota, Chef Rosie, Dakota Datebook, Plain Folk, or Why?
All you have to do is ask.
Alexa, play Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Darcy Bakkegaard. She is the Prairie Public Teacher Ambassador, and we're here to chat about the Great American Read. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is the Great American Read?
The Great American Read is one of the things on PBS I'm most excited for because I love books. And it's a rare journey into books with the main goal of getting people to read and discuss their favorite novels of all time.
So how do we go about deciding what are the favorite novels of all time?
Well, they've done the first step for us and have pulled together a list of 100 books from a variety of surveys and whittling the list down. So you can find the list of the Great American Read books, the top 100 books to vote from. And you can check out the first episode of The Great American Read on May 22nd from 7 to 9 p.m. They'll introduce these books that America loves to read.
I'm a little wondering how they're doing this as a TV show. Is it a TV show about reading?
It is. It's a TV show about reading, about writing, about why we love the books we love, about what makes a great book. So tomorrow night, the 22nd is a 2-hour-long special that introduces the books to everyone and kind of lays out what are the books on the list. Meredith Vieira will take us through what everyone loves. And then the next episodes don't air until the fall. They start in September. And those will be more thematic episodes where they break down chunks of the books together and talk about the themes of the novels and how that appears in different books. And there'll be 5 of those episodes.
It's kind of a master class for the country about how to read a book.
Yeah. And what a great way to also spark a master class of conversations about books.
Do we know how they picked this initial list of 100 books?
What I read was they did a nationwide survey in order to get the top 100 books. They did have a group of 13 literary industry professionals that helped curate the list a little further, and there were some restrictions. It's only fiction. No author has more than one book. So for me, some of my favorite authors have multiple books. Only one is on the list. And any book that was part of a series of books, the series counts as one book. So Harry Potter doesn't get multiple entries. Harry Potter is considered one entry in our 100 favorite books.
But you might get 8 times the amount of votes or however many books are in that
exactly.
series. Like if number 6 is your favorite, you're still voting for book 1?
Exactly.
Maybe?
You're still voting for the whole story and the whole world of Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or the Game of Thrones as a series.
Okay. Well, I've got this list in front of me. And
yeah.
Some of them are no surprise. Moby Dick's there. Herman Melville, of course. A well-known old novel. But then you've got The Da Vinci Code from Dan Brown, The Godfather, Mario Puzo, The Hunger Games, the series, Suzanne Collins, The Hunt for Red October, Tom Clancy, Watchers, Dean Koontz. These are like airplane beach books, you
yeah.
know.
yeah. They're books that people love to read. So certainly some people I've spoken to as a high school English teacher, there are some that are no-brainers. You know, every high school English teacher, we
To
love,
Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes, To Kill a Mockingbird. There are a lot of books that people will recognize from their high school English days, but there are a lot of beach reads of things that would surprise the average English teacher, like 50 Shades of Grey made the list. And I'll be honest, I have not read that book, but it's books that people were excited to read, were excited to talk about reading, and so we have this list, very eclectic list of 100 books.
Well, that might be the one where we wait for the graphic novel version.
Sure. That might be too graphic of a novel, even for us.
Speaking of which, though, are there any graphic novels on the list?
I didn't see any.
I didn't either, yeah.
No.
And that's a new genre that's really getting out there.
I think the most current book that's on the list is from 2016, but the books go all the way back to the 1600s. So we have things like Pilgrim's Progress on the list, which that surprised me as much as 50 Shades of Grey. That's a great stalwart. Yeah, it's a big span. But there are some books on here that I look at and go, yes, that's a well-known classic. I didn't love reading it when I read it, but I appreciated it as a piece of art and as literature.
So people can kind of read along, I take it.
They can read along. The whole goal would be to have a conversation about these books. So you have the entire summer. The list is published. There's a nice quiz you can take on PBS.org to help you figure out how many books that you've read. And for me, I'm setting my summer reading goals around this list to read some of the books that I know I should have read prior to now, but just haven't. So that's where I'm starting with Their Eyes Are Watching God. I started it this weekend because I have shockingly never read that book. So I'm taking care of some of my I gotta read it.
Well, you're not alone on that one. So Zora Neale Hurston.
Yes.
Okay. And people can find the list at pbs.org/Great American Read.
And a lot of other great information on the Great American Read Project. See some videos of some of your favorite people talking about their favorite books and get some ideas of how you might start a nice summer reading conversation.
I know the Prairie Public Education Department, and that's where you are housed within the Prairie Public family, does a lot of outreach and work with teachers. Now this is, of course, going over the summer. Is there some outreach that the Education Department is doing with the Great American Read?
Yes. PBS has a program called the Digital Innovators Program, which highlights great teachers throughout the country. And the Digital Innovators Project this summer, we're in different teams of people, and I'm in the English language group, and we will be producing a 3-part web series on the Great American Read designed for 6th through 12th grade teachers so they can get some inspiration and some ideas on how to spark the love of learning with kids in their classroom. So that will be coming out in the fall.
So this is like a curricular opportunity for those teachers.
It is, as well as just that general stimulation of conversations will bring those conversations and help build in some supports for teachers to use that in their classrooms.
Are there any real rules on voting? Do you have to be 18? Do you have to have read half of the books?
You don't. You need to just have a favorite book, and then you can vote. The official voting will open tomorrow night, May 22nd, after the opening episode airs, and you can vote via the voting app on the Great American Read website, or you can post an original post on Facebook or Twitter. So you can't comment on someone else's post. You would have to make a new post on your page, and they have a whole list of designated hashtags.
Oh, nice.
So most of them are pretty obvious. You can find all the hashtags also on pbs.org/Great American Read. And there are things like hashtag vote 1984 if you want to vote for 1984, which will be getting at least one of my votes. And you can vote on each platform for any number of books that you want. So if you had 5 books that you love, you could vote for all 5 of them on Facebook and on Twitter every single day. And then starting this fall, when the episodes pick back up on September 11th, they will also be opening text voting as well as phone line voting. So in the fall, you'll have 4 different ways that you can vote every single day.
So when does the voting end?
It ends October 18th, and that will close the voting, and they will put together the finale episode. So they have no idea what's going to be in that content. They will be watching the votes unfold and then producing the series finale in short order after the 18th.
And there will be one book that is the favorite novel of those 100 pre-selected books.
Yes.
Wow.
But perhaps more importantly, it is sparking a nationwide conversation about books.
Books and about why we love to read and about what makes a great book. So just like you said, that some of these are great classics. Some of them are what we would think of as beach reads. And it's not about saying what is the most artistically perfect book. It's about what books spark that love of reading. So there's everything on here, including children's books. Mm-hmm. The Hatchet, which was one of my favorite books when I was 9 years old. I loved Hatchet and that whole Gary Paulsen series. Things like Charlotte's Web is on here. The Little Prince. A lot of Where the Red Fern Grows. Some of those books that might have been your first love of reading where you read this book and it changed how you thought about something. Those are on this list, as well as some beach reads, as well as some classics. It's a beautifully diverse group of books.
Well, it's interesting what you said earlier, that people aren't allowed to comment on other people's posts, because, you know, like websites like Goodreads, when you go to read a review, some of those comments get a little
snarky,
divisive.
A little divisive. And I've already seen that in talking to people. A lot of literary folks, perhaps like English teachers like me, are, as I said, a little surprised with things like 50 Shades of Grey being on, and Twilight being on the same list as Catch-22 and To Kill a Mockingbird. But it's all about, what are people reading? What are they excited about reading? And certainly the list isn't all-inclusive. Some of my favorite books sadly did not make the list.
And is there a way for people to, like, can you add in, or no, this
no,
is
no, this is the list.
The
this 100. Is what we're voting off of. Okay. I would be very surprised if a write-in vote was counted and if something like that would be a dark horse and come from behind to win.
This is a very interesting way to kind of analyze, you know, popular culture as well, because what we're talking about, a lot of these books are that.
Yes, it's a lot of popular culture, and certainly that was part of it, to get a glimpse in the multicultural diversity of America and have a conversation about who's reading what and what are Americans reading. So while the books are from around the globe, anything that has been published in English, even if it was written by a foreign author, so you have Russian voices and Nigerian voices and certainly English voices, as long as it was written in English, it's about what Americans are reading.
Are we learning about how they're published as well? I mean, will they be discovering whether people are reading these on Kindles or other ebook platforms?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if they're gathering data on that, but I'm very curious about that. I know my reading has shifted more and more to my Kindle as I travel.
Oh, yeah. They are very slick.
A lot lighter than packing the 6 or 7 beach reads that I would otherwise bring with me.
So this is kind of a PBS gift to the publication industry as well, in terms of telling them what people are reading, what they particularly want to read again, and maybe, you know, how often they're doing it.
I think that's a great point. And I think it's also a great gift to the public of getting us a focus for having that conversation about reads. Selfishly, as the English teacher in me, I'm excited that we're highlighting this need and the desire to talk about books and model that in a way for our young people who sometimes feel like they only talk about books in English class, and what difference does this make? This, to me, is a great gift of showing them that people read beyond high school. And after high school, you get to choose. And that, to me, is what this list is all about. You get to choose what you love to read, not what someone else is telling you to read.
Well, Main Street is going to be hosting a series of roundtable shows between now and the end of The Great American Read. So tune in to Main Street regularly. We hope that you do anyway. And once a month, we'll have a roundtable discussion on some of these books.
Darcy Bakkegaard is Prairie Public's teacher ambassador. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dakota Date Book is next.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we'd kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people, because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're not cobwebby old school marms. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 21st. We do not know a whole lot about the lifetime of Columbus Larsen, but we know he left a town-naming legacy in North Dakota. Columbus Larsen was born in Wisconsin in 1855 to Norwegian immigrants who apparently had a sly sense of humor, giving him a first name honoring the famous Italian explorer Christopher Columbus, to go with his entirely Norwegian last name. After Wisconsin, Columbus Larsen spent some time in Minnesota and then, in 1902, migrated to northwestern North Dakota. He established a land claim just 5 miles from the Canadian border. Other settlers came, traveling north from Minot through Kenmare. Columbus Larsen became the local postmaster in 1903, and when an actual town formed, it was called Columbus. Then, the next town to the west became Larsen. The village of Columbus was on the Sioux Railway, and the town of Larsen was along the Great Northern Railway. Columbus and Larsen were separated by only 4 miles. The town of Columbus grew bigger and faster than Larsen. In 1920, Columbus had a population of 332, while Larsen had 114. Both towns benefited from the Whittier Crockett coal mine, 4 miles south of Columbus. The village of Larsen was profiled in an article in the Bismarck Tribune published on this date back in 1914 with the headline, "Larsen, the town that has a brilliant future, also has numerous industries, an aggressive and boosting bunch of good businessmen." The article chronicled the legend of Columbus Larsen in this way. When Columbus Larsen came west from Minnesota and took up a claim in northwestern Burke County, he little dreamed that the guardian angel had sent him to name a new town. Both towns, Columbus and Larsen, thrived for a while, but declined drastically during the 1930s Depression. They faded further, and in the 1990s, the Columbus High School shut down. While Columbus is still a city, Larsen has lost that status and is now called a census-designated place. As for Columbus Larsen, he and his wife Mary moved away to California. It was there, in Los Angeles, that the distinctively named Norwegian-American Columbus Larsen died on June 4, 1920. His legacy still preserved by Tiny Larsen and Columbus in North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
President Trump meets North Korea's leader on June 12, unless, after North Korean complaints, he doesn't.
We may have the meeting, we may not have the meeting. If we don't have it, that will be very interesting.
First, South Korea's leader visits President Trump. Does this set up a bid to take nuclear weapons from the North? On the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, if you like to make pies and cakes and tarts and cookies, the Great American Baking Show wants you. We'll talk with casting producer Mary Fanto about the show and how you or a great baker you know can apply to be a contestant. We hope you'll join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.